there's two sides to every story, right? A lot of society, they just see in one light. There's black and there's white, but there's a lot of gray, and that's like kind of where we are.
What I've seen is most group homes don't really know how to deal with kids. They just take one big generalization of all kids and say, well, this is how we're going to deal with it, and it's not going to be any other way.
Young offenders, people think of it as peanut time. It's hardcore.
So maybe those kind of stories should be shared with adults out there who are like, yeah, those kids aren't getting it hard enough.
The public doesn't know.
Today we're going to be talking about street life. We have our three guests just to come and share their experiences. And,
are you sure we're on air?
We're on air. Don't worry about it.
I have a family. It's a gang. They're there for me, so I'll be there for them too. And they know what your needs are and stuff. Like myself, people that are lost, they find each other.
Well, I'm a gangster girl, straight up prankster girl. Only ghetto girl surviving my world. Growing up on the streets of E-Town, I never had the time to fuck around. Cause money is low, as y'all should know. So I gotta go and get me my dough. Gotta do my shit right, gotta keep my shit tight. Things fuck up, I'm gonna put up a fight. Cause there ain't no way I'm going back, which means there ain't no time for me to slack. In this ghetto life, I made a deal to do my thing and keep it real.
How long have each of you been homeless for?
Like 4 years off and on.
What about you, Ariel?
Pretty close to like 5 to 6 years. And I started skipping school and being disobedient towards my mom. And she couldn't put up with me anymore. She couldn't stand me. She didn't know what to do. She got to the point where she was like, oh, I don't know what to do anymore. Just leave. And so I did.
You didn't mind leaving because she asked you to?
Didn't really matter. I got arrested when I left. And then after that, I was just like, Mom, can I come home? And she's like, no, I can't let you back here. I just don't know what to do with you. You say you're gonna do right, and all you ever do is fuck up.
Let's talk about the basics for a second. Over the past couple of years, what have you eaten?
If you're homeless, like, there's always different ways to get free food, right, from restaurants. Like, you know, everybody's got their little scams, and they do it, and it's like, you know,
like
it works.
Singing?
Like yesterday, I won't lie, straight up, I stole the Save the Children change box from Tim Hortons on Jasper. But it said Save the Children, right? I'm like, hey, you know, I need to be, I'm fucking homeless, you know what I mean? So I fucking stole it.
Child welfare came into our lives because of alcohol and violence and our background, my mom's criminal past, my dad. Their story of family is just normal family. When they go in there with a cop and a social worker, how does it make them feel when they see loved ones taken apart? Imagine if that happened to them. If you know nothing about the systems, the social workers will just screw you and play hit games with you. It's just a whole big game. That's all life's about. There's a game in here, there's a game out on the streets, and there's a game everywhere you go.
You said that they can just do searches to you whenever they want.
I had just gotten home yesterday, and I had found out cops had already gone through my room. They had, like, turned everything upside down because they had suspected drugs in the group home. I just can't handle that kind of...
I'm the one in my whole family that's been in care this long. My brother got out, my sisters got out. I don't know, I hate child welfare. But until I'm out, it's tough to deal with it.
I've been in lockup for a long time. I get out and then go back. I got so used to it, it was normal for me to be locked up in there because that's all I knew was to be locked up.
Jail's the digger, the hole, it's where you go. To paint the picture of it, it's a room, it's dirty. It's very dirty, I mean that. You wear a baby doll, it's a really heavy material dress. Yeah, it really feeds into the punishment. You don't get a mattress, no pillow. You get one Bible, it's hardcore, man. No phone call, your meals are just dirt. You eat with your fingers.
There's no respect whatsoever. When you turn 18?
I think it's pretty much a curse. You get to be a legal alcoholic on welfare.
Didn't teach me how to survive without them. And I've had structure. I've had someone actually drive me to school, drive me to appointments, take me here, take me there, and now all of a sudden I'm out on my own, and I have to do it all by myself. It's too hard.
I know how to make my own choices, but who cares? Why make my choices when other people can make them for me?
It's been the worst nightmare. Probably being on the street, I guess.
Here is a story about walking the other day, and every day is
Hello?
Special.
Hello?
Something who are you? Just never
this
changed.
Is Pete.
Well,
I don't think, I think there's someone else going to be hooked up. And, okay, asking this question. What are you, what group are you in? She looks I'm in away, prison. Okay, oh, you're sway, in prison. I guess okay. It's another
boy day. Blow me.
John. Pig.
Prostitution.
Really fucked up in the head.
Sugar daddies.
Dirty old men.
Tricks.
Low life.
Escorted.
It's like an addiction.
I don't like the guys that pick up girls because they're just sick. I think John should be shot. I think especially if they're picking up the young ones, which there's a lot of young ones out there. They don't understand, like, how much emotional distress they're causing these girls. And some of them don't have a choice. Like, my mom, she started me off prostitution, and I didn't really have a choice, you know? I was 10, just turned 10.
Violence has been living at home. Violence has been being on the streets. Violence has been being in relationships.
I despise them. I don't like child welfare at all. They force me to do things, and I don't like being forced. Be controlled. And a lot of people get hurt, as you can hear. The thing I hate is the staff, the way they control you. They force you in there, so that's restraint. When I get restrained, I feel like going around and putting them into the wall. When I was a little girl, I used to get abused physically and emotionally by my mom and my mom's boyfriends whenever she told them to. I just hate when people put their hands on me.
Going to jail is like a breeding ground for criminals, is basically what it is. They go in there and it teaches them nothing but robbing, crooking, and hustling and stealing. It's a lose-lose situation.
Lockup doesn't help. If you're, like, new to the system and you just hook up with all these people who have these problems, then you would have never tried working the street. You would have never tried these drugs. All of a sudden, one day, your life changes. You're on the street. You're smoking crack. It just gets worse in the system.
To all those people doing lines, don't do it, don't do it. Inject your soul with liberty. It's free, it's free.
As soon as I got money, I would go and pick up drugs. I'd smoke those drugs while I was waiting to get picked up again, and then I'd get picked up again, and then I'd get some more drugs, and then I'd do those drugs, and then I'd get picked up again. It's like that all day long.
I've been on drugs and streets for 6 years, and I'm alive. I think I say I'm a survivor. Like, towards the end of my stay, I was like, I'm not an addict, fuck that. And I was totally going off, and I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. And one day, I sat there in a group, somebody's talking, and I got up, looking into the mirror, and I'm like, holy fuck. And everybody's looking at me, and I had tears in my eyes, and I'm like, I'm a fucking addict. And I just broke down. I never acknowledged it before, never.
I used to smoke $15,000 of crack a month.
So until I die, two for when I hope to God that my soul will fly. Hope to God that my soul will fly.
I'm not a confused kid. I'm nobody's bitch.
Need gangs, they don't need prostitution. They don't need alcohol or drugs to survive.
Would you say a lot of people know that though?
They're blind. They're blinded by the money.
They know it. They just choose not to listen. It's always easier to do it one way than the other.
What would you do if you could to make them more aware of that? That seems like the message you want to get across.
Keep your head up, look for a brighter day, and get through all this shit.
Yeah. I believe kids like us, if we do straighten out in time, and we do go to school, we turn out to be great things, and we put a lot into our community.
Oh, okay.
Add up.
Salut. Ben, le Rapsin travaille au... C'est un regroupement d'organismes, de 59 organismes qui travaillent directement auprès des personnes itinérantes à Montréal. Dans le milieu de la judiciarisation, mais c'est sûr, c'est une portion super importante du travail qu'on effectue quotidiennement. Ça. Et il n'y a pas très longtemps, il y a une trentaine d'organismes qui sont regroupés autour de la table jeunesse itinérance du centre-ville et... et du réseau d'aide aux personnes seules itinérantes. Je continue. OK. Donc, il y a une trentaine d'organismes qui sont regroupés sous cette bannière-là pour développer une pratique de défense de droits auprès directement des personnes itinérantes et sinon de colliger de l'information pour pouvoir faire des pressions politiques et autres. Et là-dedans, ce qu'on a constaté, on a fait une collecte de contraventions, de plusieurs contraventions émises l'été dernier, pas loin de 200 contraventions. Et ce que ça a révélé, c'est que la très forte majorité des infractions reprochées, c'est des infractions qu'on ne reprocherait pas à l'ensemble de la population. Alors, on a des libellés particulièrement comiques, même si la situation est loin d'être drôle. Traverser une rue à un feu rouge, traverser ailleurs qu'à une intersection, jeter de la cendre puis des mégots de cigarettes par terre, coucher sur deux espaces de bancs de parc, s'être lavé les cheveux avec un abreuvoir, puis même être assis sur une table à pique-nique ou sur un muret de béton dans un parc, ça, c'est sujet à infraction. Bien entendu qu'il y a une grosse discrimination là-dedans, justement, parce que la majorité du monde ne se ferait jamais reprocher des infractions de cette façon-là. Il y a aussi un gros harcèlement, on peut vraiment parler d'harcèlement, parce que des fois, c'est dans un délai record, des fois, en dedans de 15 minutes, on peut recevoir 2-3 constats d'infraction ou pour différents motifs. Il y a aussi toute la question des coûts qui s'accumulent pour ces personnes-là. Bref, là, c'est la panacée. C'est une problématique là, qu'on voit là, par rapport à l'itinérance qui est extrêmement redevenue vraiment dramatique, là, importante. Il n'y en a pas beaucoup. C'est pour ça qu'il faut essayer d'en créer le plus possible. Avec la pratique de défense des droits qu'on a développée, l'idée, c'était vraiment plus d'informer ou de former plus les... travailler pour plus que les intervenants puissent se former entre eux autres et se regrouper pour en parler, pour savoir comment peuvent parler aux personnes itinérantes, comment peuvent discuter de cette question-là, puis de les aider. C'est sûr que dans le cas de constat d'infraction, la première chose, c'est contester un ticket. C'est à peu près la seule chose possible à faire rapidement. C'est sûr qu'il y a des recours comme souvent dans la manière dont les infractions sont remises, bien, c'est facile. On pourrait aller en déontologie policière. Sauf que c'est sûr que pour une personne itinérante, suivre une espèce de processus super lourd comme la déontologie policière, déposer une plainte comme ça, c'est super laborieux. Fait que, l'autre objet, c'est toujours comme dans n'importe quoi vis-à-vis du phénomène de l'itinérance, c'est la sensibilisation, c'est parler, se montrer en fait aux citoyens et citoyennes que c'est pas des personnes qui sont dangereuses. Puis que c'est justement parce qu'on les considère un peu dangereuses que la police intervient en ce sens-là. Et même si la police et les institutions amplifient ce problème-là par ce biais-là. Surtout aussi que la situation ne sert absolument à rien, la judiciarisation. Les policiers nous disent, écoutez, ils vont se déplacer, ils vont s'en aller ailleurs. Fait qu'on déplace le problème. Les personnes reviennent dans le quartier. Fait que le problème n'est même pas réglé. Puis pendant ce temps-là, ben c'est tout le monde qui paye pour ça. Puis ça ne sert à rien. Fait que le ticketing, là, c'est... une pratique vraiment là, à mettre aux poubelles, mais il va falloir montrer à bien du monde à quel point ça marche pas pour pouvoir y arriver.
Mm-hmm. Peut-être là-dessus, Anna, tu pourrais partager une partie de ton expérience en tant que travailleuse de rue, parce que toi aussi, tu faillis étiqueter pour avoir été dans un parc après les heures de fermeture, parce qu'il fallait que tu sois là pour ton travail.
Ouais, mais en fait, bon... Moi, je travaille surtout dans le quartier Centre-Sud. Puis souvent, bon, les policiers, c'est sûr, ils répondent aux plaintes des gens. Puis une façon de montrer des fois que oui, ils vont faire leur travail, parce que souvent, on ne sait pas quoi faire, là, puis il n'y en a pas de solution miracle. Puis ils disent, bien ça, c'en est une solution. Dans le fond, c'est pour, j'imagine, montrer qu'ils font quelque chose, qu'ils sont efficaces d'une façon ou d'une autre, là. Puis c'est ça, tout ce que ça fait, dans le fond, c'est que ça marginalise encore plus des gens qui le sont déjà. Ça les met dans des situations qui sont encore plus précaires. Puis bon, admettons, je sais pas, je prends quelqu'un qui quête, admettons, ou qui fait du squeegee, qui reçoit des étiquettes, mais comment il va les payer, ces étiquettes? Fait que souvent, il va aller faire du temps en prison à un moment donné quand il tombe sous mandat, ou il faut qu'il continue à faire encore plus de squeegee ou quêter ou faire de la prostitution pour pouvoir payer ses étiquettes. Fait que, en fait, ça change absolument rien. Puis ça précarise encore plus certaines situations, puis marginalise encore plus certaines personnes. Mm-hmm. Puis dans le fond, c'est d'appliquer des lois, mais si on les applique dépendamment des individus. Parce que moi, un ticket pour cracher de partage, j'en ai jamais eu, puis probablement que j'en aurais pas, t'sais. Mais aussitôt qu'on semble...
Toi,
par nos quatre. Bon. Aussitôt qu'on peut avoir un âge, justement, qu'on va être considéré personne itinérante ou travailleuse du sexe, mais là, c'est ça, on va appliquer les lois d'une autre façon.
Mm-hmm. Alors, à part l'étiquette, quelles d'autres mesures existent pour criminaliser les sans-abri? Peut-être, Alex, tu pourrais en parler d'un projet qui a vu le jour récemment, comme le plan d'optimisation de police de quartier. So, just to give a translation of what we said, we've been talking about measures of criminalization of the homelessness, and we've been talking about ticketing, but there are other measures that exist, and Alex, I would like you to elaborate on one of them, if you could.
Ouais, ben le service de police de la ville de Montréal a déposé ce qu'il appelle un plan d'optimisation de la police de quartier, mais c'est pas à cause qu'il appelle ça un plan d'optimisation que ça doit nous rendre optimistes, au contraire. Il y a différents aspects au plan d'optimisation, mais je vais aller à l'essentiel, c'est que il est question de faire des incivilités, puis quand je dis incivilités, on va mettre des petits guillemets autour de tout ça. Donc, il est question de faire des incivilités une priorité du service de police de la ville de Montréal. Donc, quand on parle d'incivilité, évidemment, on a affaire à une expression fourre-tout, n'est-ce pas? Dans laquelle, donc, on peut mélanger toute une série d'infractions aux règlements municipaux ou des infractions au Code criminel canadien et ainsi de suite. Incivilité, c'est essentiellement une expression qui a été importée de France, n'est-ce pas? Ça n'existait pas là, dans le langage courant ici jusqu'à dernièrement. Et on fait essentiellement référence à ce qu'on appelle la petite délinquance. On désigne ça sous l'appellation d'incivilité. Maintenant, le plan d'optimisation, c'est une véritable déclaration de guerre aux incivilités, ni plus ni moins. Il est donc question d'ajouter 26 nouvelles catégories de codes d'appel. Quand on parle de codes d'appel, c'est que les policiers, on le sait, ils communiquent par les ondes radio. Et souvent, au lieu de dire, bon ben, on a une plainte pour voie de fait ou on a une plainte pour vol de banque ou je ne sais pas trop quoi, ils vont dire, on a un 406, un 407, où ils vont se référer à des numéros. Et donc, parmi les aspects les plus importants de l'optimisation de la police de quartier, il est question, ils ont adopté 26 nouvelles catégories d'appels qui ont trait aux actes d'incivilité et aux marques d'incivilité. Puis là, quand je vous disais que c'était fourre-tout, là, c'est, on a d'excellents exemples avec les nouveaux codes d'appel. Par exemple, un bâtiment délabré, ça fait, ils considèrent que c'est une marque d'incivilité, donc c'est un code d'appel. Donc, un citoyen qui voit un bâtiment délabré peut appeler son poste de quartier, puis je ne sais pas combien d'autopatrouilles qu'ils vont envoyer pour... mais en tout cas... Mais plus inquiétant et plus sérieux est le fait que à cette heure, il y a des codes d'appel, par exemple, présence de Squeegee, c'est un code d'appel. Sollicitation, mendicité agressive, tout ça, c'est tout des codes d'appel. Puis bon, puis quand on parle de mendicité agressive, là, je veux dire, moi, je pense, tu sais, faut vraiment, là, comme être très, là, fermé d'esprit, puis pas jamais avoir connu la faim dans sa vie pour percevoir de l'agressivité. Je veux dire, voyons donc quelqu'un qui n'a pas mangé de toute la journée puis qui quête, puis que, tu sais, puis le monde va percevoir ça comme étant de l'agressivité. En tout cas, certaines personnes, là, surtout ceux qui ont le ventre bien plein, vont percevoir ça comme de l'agressivité quand, au fond, je veux dire, tu sais, c'est quelqu'un qui a faim. Tu sais, pourquoi est-ce qu'on ne voit pas les besoins humanitaires à la base et ainsi de suite? Donc, on parle, en fait, de faire des personnes itinérantes et des personnes les plus pauvres de la société des cibles ambulantes pour les policiers patrouilleurs qui, bien souvent, on s'ennuient et n'ont rien à faire quand ils se promènent en char. Là, on veut en mettre à pied. Bien, pas faire des mises à pied, malheureusement, mais mettre des policiers pour qu'ils fassent de la patrouille à pied. Puis on le sait, sur qui vont tomber, ces policiers-là? Ils vont tomber sur les personnes de la rue, sur ceux qui font du squeegee, bref, sur le monde, qu'ils n'ont aucune autre place où aller. Et les policiers vont leur tomber dessus. Et l'étiquette, ça va continuer de pleuvoir. D'ailleurs, le non-paiement d'amende est une des principales causes d'incarcération au Québec. Statistique Canada, en 1999, avait sorti des chiffres incroyables, comme quoi que 60 % des admissions dans le réseau carcéral québécois était pour des non-paiements d'amendes. Si on arrêtait d'envoyer les sans-abri pour non-paiement de tickets, sûrement qu'ils devraient faire des licenciements massifs parmi les gardiens de prison, parce que c'est ça qui fait rouler essentiellement. On s'en va vers des temps toujours plus difficiles pour les personnes de la rue, malheureusement.
Merci beaucoup, Alex. Et en parlant des prisons, we have Peter Collins on air with us right now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. So I've been told that you used to be homeless in your youth, and would you like to share your experience with the criminalization?
Sure. I started running away when I was about 12, and from an early age, I was sleeping in big garbage containers to stay dry, you know, breaking into basements or apartment storage units to stay warm in the winter. And, you know, during the course of that misspent youth, I was placed in the children's aid, and, with sexual advances from the CAS worker, I ran away and I was on the street again. And when you're on the street, there's, at nighttime, the pedophiles seem to come out and they patrol the streets of the cities looking for these kids that are clearly disenfranchised and on their own. One time I was picked up by the police and driven outside of Ottawa, and while they didn't beat me up, they shoved me around and told me that, you know, if I came back, there worse would happen to me. I did go back because I wasn't very clear on messages. And again, I was grabbed by them, and under a bridge that's just outside the Parliament buildings, really, underneath the Chateau Laurier, there's a bridge where a lot of homeless people would stay, and I was choked until I was unconscious and, you know, left under the bridge. You have a lot of feelings of separation from society and
I guess this is a common practice.
Well, it was for me, and it was for the kids that I was with at the time, and I see it on the street, you know, now, like, from prison. I've been in prison for 20 years now,
mm-hmm.
and it's horrific to watch on the news the way, you know, politicians and are trying to drive street youth away, you know, try and get them out of the scope of vision of, so-called regular society, you know. Mm-hmm. We're criminalizing those kids that have already had a hard start, either in the home or in the juvenile system or in the Children's Aid Society. You know, these kids have had psychological abuse, so they're hungry, they're exploited, and instead of helping these kids, we're driving them into a harsher side of life, mm-hmm. you know. It's a much easier place to adopt a criminal lifestyle when you recognize that no one else is caring for you, and, you know, that's... crime is sort of a non-discriminating employer, you know, and there's really only four choices for disenfranchised kids, and that's deal drugs, petty crime, prostitution, or begging, you know. So what do we want from those kids?
All of which are criminalized as well, and now they're giving themselves all these laws to legitimize the criminalization. So in your opinion, what will the consequences of this be? On the future generations that are growing up on the streets and choosing it as their life environment?
Well, I don't know what the I don't see good things for them. You know, for myself, I ended up, my crimes got bigger and bigger. Eventually, a policeman died while I was robbing a bank. You know, it's been 20 years since then. I've been in prison. I don't know. You know, I guess we can see what's going to happen when we look at the stories of, those women who were sex workers in British Columbia being found dug up in a pig farm, you know, or the 80 missing women in Edmonton, sex workers. You know, oftentimes if you trace back through their experience, you'll find that they were homeless, that they were, you know, disenfranchised from society. And that was, they were either exploited by people and forced into that line of work because they didn't have any support or they, had no choice themselves but to go into that line of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we criminalize them for that and someone preys on them.
Right. And so you can't be inside because you don't have a place, and you can't be outside anymore because this just isn't safe. So, Peter, we have Dee with us, and she has questions for you.
Okay. Okay.
If you take them. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious, like, what would you suggest that be done, you know, to avoid this criminalization of youth? What could society do?
I'm not entirely sure. You know, we have to reach out and offer legitimate, non-judgmental support that encourages, people to... I don't know. Society needs to look at the way they're behaving in regard to kids who are, you know, whose lives are in crisis, and we need to just be more aware. We need to look at, you know, like, these are our kids. These are our, you know, they're someone's kids. You know, we need to take care of them. If someone's not taking care of them, somehow we've got to put in mechanisms that can care for them. So I guess it's a pretty big a big question. I don't know, you know, how we're going to do that.
We also have Tulin Odegar on the line with us. Can you hear me? Hello? All right, maybe we'll get to her later. So now we're going to turn to Brett, who did some research on criminalization of panhandling in Manitoba. And so would you talk about that?
I think we're having a really important and interesting discussion. Kim Pate of the Elizabeth Fry Societies, who's a prisoner rights activist, has said that jails are our most comprehensive homelessness initiative, and I think this is an interesting way to frame things, because what we're seeing in provinces across the country is initiatives that are aimed at people who are disenfranchised, who are without homes, who are on the street, but they're not initiatives that are addressing the root problems of homelessness or the problem of the issue of finding safe places for people to live. And I think that definitely in Ontario we saw this with the Safe Streets Act, which was passed by the provincial Tory government in 1999, and it basically was issued under the banner of dealing with so-called aggressive panhandling, and it was being framed as some sort of epidemic. And what happened with the Safe Streets Act was that, panhandlers or squeegee workers or people on the streets who are deemed to be aggressive, which is, you know, an aggressiveness is something that was up to the discretion of the police who are implementing this law, were given tickets, were, picked up by the police, intimidated, put in jail. And, what it was basically an attempt to drive the poor out of the public eye in Toronto, and really had little to do with ending aggression. And I think the other thing is that this was taking place in a context where the government was also implementing massive cuts to social spending. Welfare was cut by 21.6%. Affordable housing units were cut dramatically, and so you saw sort of an explosion of people who were being forced out into the street, and then on top of everything, they were being criminalized by their government and by the police force. Another thing that was going on in Ontario was something called target policing, where police forces basically went into poor neighborhoods primarily, and they would go undercover and basically saturate these neighborhoods, and everyone would get stopped and harassed and ticketed and intimidated. So I think definitely we should be talking about what is at the root of these practices, what the aims are, who is pushing for them, and what they speak to in terms of how some people are humanized and some people aren't. We also have Rod Graham on the line, and he is, we have Roy on the line. Hello, Roy?
Yes, hello, I can hardly hear you.
Oh, sorry about that, I will try and speak louder, how's that?
Okay, a little bit, not much.
Okay, Roy, do you, what would you like to say to us today?
Well, I've been listening to your comments on the radio with regards to the problems with some of the homeless people there in Montreal and other parts of the world. And I'm in a federal penitentiary. And when I watch what goes on the outside world, because our television basically is the eye out into the universe, and I see that what is going on with the homeless people, it's very sad, because I somehow sometimes feel that we're very fortunate. Even though we're sitting in jail, some of those people out there, they're freezing on the street, they're starving, and